Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, in today's show, we want to talk about some announcements and developments globally and in the U.S. here in terms of the economy and politics at the outset of the show. And then in the second half of the show, I want to say something about assessing the general military situation in Ukraine. You know, we have Blinken here, Secretary of State Blinken and Zelensky both announcing, here comes the offensive. So that may materialize very soon. It's kind of like two boxers in the ring here, circling each other, waiting for the other guy to throw the first blow, offensive, the new offensive here. There's been talk about Russia offensive, Ukraine offensive. Which offensive are we going to see first? And who's the counterpuncher here in the ring? Both sides kind of waiting for the other to commit itself so that they can concentrate their counteroffensive. Okay, so second half, I want to talk about my assessment of where this situation, this war militarily, is at in Ukraine and what could be transpiring very soon. I kind of think that 23 is going to be a critical juncture year for the outcome of this war. One side or the other is going to get the upper hand before the end of the year. Anyway, you know, we will come back to that topic. But let's start off with some news of the week that's important. Well, first of all, we got another jobs report here this morning, and another well over 200,000 jobs created. So that's not good news for the Fed. The media's tried to put a spin on it. Oh, it's not as bad as it was previous months. Yeah, well, but when you're over 200,000 jobs, technically the labor market is still pretty robust. And we know that Fed Chair Powell is really looking at the labor market, anything he can find to justify whether he should stop raising rates. And the fact that we got over 200,000 jobs again probably is not going to convince him. I've been predicting we're going to have a rate increase, another one here in May from the Fed, probably only a quarter of a percent, because the Fed rate hikes are in dangerous territory now in this 5 to 6% range that I've said many times starts having consequences for the financial banking system. And we've seen that, of course, already with these banks in the West, Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, and now First Republic Bank that's hanging on by a thread. I'll talk more about the indicators shortly here. So the Fed's going to continue raising rates because it's not seeing a softening of the labor market. It's targeting the labor market. But also, as I've said, these job number reports are questionable. In my opinion, I think the labor market is softer than being reported and the spin being given by the Fed. As I've said before, I'm not going to go into great detail, but the problems with these job numbers are these job numbers reflect what's called full-time permanent jobs. The unemployment rate, 3.5%. It ignores the 60 million people in the U.S. who are not full-time employed, who are part-time, and who are temps and contractors and so forth. So it ignores them. If they were added, we might have a different picture here in terms of the unemployment rate. And certainly the total unemployed, right? Also, you got to realize in the early phases of business cycle, businesses tend to shed full-time and add part-time because part-time is less costly. There's no benefits. You can lay them off quicker. You don't have to pay them overtime and so forth. So you know, that's been going on for some time. Businesses are shedding full-time and adding part-time. And, of course, if you shed a full-time job and add two part-time jobs, then it looks like you're adding jobs to the economy. You know, these statistics from the Labor Department don't measure people working. They measure jobs. You know, you can have someone taking on a second, third job, which is happening. And it looks like you got job creation, but you still only have one person employed. So that's one of the problems with these job numbers. Another problem is what's called vacation number. The job number here that's being bandied around is from large corporations, establishments, they call them, you know, maybe 400,000, whatever, who report to the government. A lot of small businesses where you have a lot of part-timers aren't in that number. And that number from the large corporations is bolstered by another statistic on new businesses being formed. The problem with new business formation data being added to the enterprise data is that it's lagged 6 to 9 months. So a good part of what you see is what was actually happened in terms of jobs 6 to 9 months ago added to the report from the large enterprises to the government, considering, you know, based on their hiring and their employment levels. And the problem with that new business formation is it's a net number. In other words, every month, hundreds of thousands of new jobs are created, and hundreds of thousands of small businesses go out of business. So what's the net difference is the number that's given to the Labor Department. And there's assumptions about, you know, every new job, you know, how many employees are hired when a new company is formed. And the problem with that is the government guesstimates a lot of that because they have data on new businesses being formed, but they have no data on businesses going out of business. People don't report going out of business month to month. So, in other words, the new business formation data is props up the job numbers artificially, and it's not all that accurate either. And then, as I said, another factor here is during COVID, businesses, of course, laid off a huge percentage of its employment. The problem with that is they haven't really brought people back, and they're operating at like 70-80% of normal in 2019. So, you know, they're not going to lay people off in large numbers like they might have back in 2008. So, in other words, you got to look at the details, or as an economist say, what's going on at the micro level in the labor markets to really understand what's going on. You just can't look at the aggregate number of the jobs created according to the definition of the Labor Department. Got to look at the, you know, behind that number. What's going on behind that number? How accurate is it? Okay, so that's the jobs report today. Bottom line, it means the Fed's going to continue raising rates here because, quote, the job market has not really softened significantly enough for the Fed to stop raising rates, and the Fed is targeting the job market because it knows that the job market is key. If you generate a large amount of unemployment, that means a lot of people don't have the income to buy things. And if they don't buy things, goods and services, well, then the price of those come down. So the Fed's always been targeting creating unemployment in order to bring wages and spending, worker spending, household spending down, which would dampen demand for goods and services and bring it down. But as I said many, many times on this show, most of inflation is not due to workers' wages and spending. Most of inflation is not demand side, it's supply side. Meaning global trends and conditions driving up energy prices. We'll talk about that shortly. And industrial commodity prices and other global exports and import prices. Corporate price gouging here in the U.S., especially oil companies and other monopolistic companies. These are things keeping the inflation rate up that the Fed can't do anything about by simply raising interest rates. So we'll continue watching that, but very clearly the Fed's going to continue raising rates here because it's a target indicator of the labor market is not softening the way it predicts. And that's because inflation is mostly supply side still. You know, maybe 60%, two-thirds are supply and monopolistic price gouging. And as I said, rising unit labor costs due to productivity falling. Those are the real causes of most of the inflation. And the Fed can't do anything about that. It says it can't, doesn't even talk about it. It just kind of concentrates on, generating more unemployment to bring down wage income and consumption and therefore demand for goods and services and prices. You know, if you look at the past year, 5%, the most rapid increase in Fed rates in its history over the past year, 5%. What did they get? Well, instead of 8.5%, we're down to 6%. So we got a 2.5%, which is the demand side composition of inflation. Reduction here, but we're still at 5.5-6%. And the Fed can't raise rates much farther without precipitating more banking instability. The Fed is between a rock and a hard place. As I've said many times since 2017 in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, that Fed monetary policy is inefficient, increasingly inefficient. And by that, I mean that lowering interest rates to zero, which it did for many years, does not stimulate the real economy, GDP, the way it used to. And that's because we got a financialized economy, and the Fed injection of supply of money to stimulate through low interest rates, stimulate investment, does not work as well as it used to. And conversely, flip it upside down here, Fed policy and dampening inflation is not as efficient as it used to be either. They have to raise interest rates higher than in the past to try to dampen inflation. But as I said, because of the financialization of the economy, they can't raise rates more than 5-6% without causing financial instability, which we see beginning to emerge. So the Fed's between a rock and a hard place. But bottom line, it's going to continue very carefully raising rates and seeing what the pressure is. I believe the Fed strategy and, the policymakers in general strategy here in the U.S. is to slowly raise interest rates and see what stress it generates. But as it generates stress in the banking sector, to have selective bailouts. Let the FDIC do its job and bail out here and there, as long as it's not a generalized market-wide financial crash, contraction, as long as it's, bank by bank, that's what the Fed's going to do. But keep raising rates, in other words. Even though raising rates puts more stress on the banking system, let the regulators, FDIC and others, to bail out. And the Fed can help the bailout, too, keep it from generalizing. The FDIC, of course, we know, throws money into these institutions to cover depositors' losses. We know that. But the Fed plays a role in throwing money at it, too, liquidity, they call that, by opening up what it calls its discount window, where banks can come and borrow short-term at very low rates. And as I said, I believe a week or so ago, the Fed has the Fed and FDIC and others have put in about $400 to $500 billion into the economy in just a couple of weeks, into the banks, in other words, and investors, not the economy. You know, that's an indicator that of this strategy. The Fed will keep raising rates to deal with inflation and the stress in the banking system created. It will respond to that, and the FDIC will respond to that on a case-by-case basis, throwing money here and there, whatever. Which leads us to another item of the past week, and that's the letter to shareholders by Chase Bank CEO Jamie Dimon. Got some attention here in the media. Because what Jamie said was, look, the crisis is not over yet, quote, not over yet, right? Well, what's he referring to? Well, he's referring to the regional banking crisis primarily. And he says this is not like 2008, right? But he does say that there's repercussions that are going to continue even now after, you know, what's happened thus far. In terms of the banking situation. Well, can we break this down? What does he mean? Well, not over yet means that, look, the Fed, by throwing, and the government, FDIC, et cetera, by throwing $500 billion at it, has kind of stabilized the banking instability here, or appears to have at least stabilized it. You know, we don't have more Silicon Valley banks, Signature banks collapsing. But what we do have is bank stock prices still low. You know, stock prices during the crisis in March dropped to like 30-35% for some of these banks and small regional banks. Okay, it's still around 20-25%. So the stock prices are not recovering here. And that means investors aren't going to throw money into the banks to help them. And, of course, we got bank earnings season coming up here, and I think we're going to see some negative results there that are going to forewarn some people, you know, that the banks are not as great off as they like to think they are. There's a bank stock price index called the KBW index, which still shares the banks in general, including big banks. Their stock prices are down 20-25%. It varies company by company. But that's before the earnings season and before the fact that it's now more obvious that we're in a recession. I've been saying we're in a recession for some time. You know, the media has tried to spin it that, oh, it's not really a recession, and that we're headed for a soft landing. Well, you know, since this bank situation in the last couple of weeks, all this talk, happy talk about soft landing has disappeared. Now they're pretty much in agreement that recession is setting in. Jamie Dimon says it's not like 2008. No, it's true. It's not like 2008 yet. But you got to remember, you know, the 2008 crash in that third quarter, summer to September of 2008, didn't happen overnight. That thing had been developing at least a year before, and there were bank failures, countrywide lending failed, Bear Stearns failed, some hedge funds went under that were overexposed to housing. And then we had the government funding agencies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, they had to be bailed out. All that before you had the big Lehman collapse, you know, and WaMu and some of the others, that Merrill that went with it, AIG. So, no, it's not like that, but we're still at the very early stages of the current banking crisis. And if rates keep going up and earnings keep going down, a lot of these regional banks are going to be in trouble, especially those who I believe are overexposed to the commercial property market. Commercial property, particularly office buildings and malls, and to some extent resorts, et cetera. Those sectors of the commercial property economy are loaded up with junk debt, junk bond debt, junk loan debt, leverage loans, et cetera, to stay alive over the last decade. So they are overexposed, and we're going to have a big wave of refinancing that junk debt at the end of this year, early in next year. And I think we're going to see the stress then. So it may not be a residential housing contraction, as in 2008, precipitating everything, but it may be a commercial property contraction, not a residential property, but a commercial property. And that's still to come. Also, retail is in trouble, also loaded up on junk debt, big box retail in particular. Malls are going away. You know, they're collapsing, and they're trying to convert them to other uses across the country, you know, like emergency housing and so forth. So, it's not like 2008, but it's still early. We don't know whether it will be like 2008. And usually these crashes, financial crashes, come in from a direction that the regulators weren't really anticipating. You know, no, it's not going to be residential housing again like it was. They got that covered. But it could be, and probably will be, from some other direction, maybe commercial property, maybe even something else. We don't know yet. But the point is, no, I agree with Jamie Dimon. It's not like 2008 yet, and it won't be exactly like 2008. Repercussions are already happening, though, especially for the real economy. What it means is bank lending is now tightening up, and the debate is, well, will this be a credit slowdown or a credit crunch? Credit crunch means banks stop lending and rolling over the junk debt for zombie companies. And those zombie companies, if they can't roll over that debt, they just go bankrupt. And if they go bankrupt, all the investors and other banks that invested in these zombie companies then have contagion effects, and they're in trouble. And before you know it, everything spreads like wildfire to other banks and other institutions, because everybody's lending to everybody else, you know, and one guy fails, well, the other guy has the loss, and he fails, and two more guys have a loss. The banking system is like a big spider web here, or better metaphor perhaps is like cancerous cells that have spread throughout the whole body into all the organs and so forth. So, repercussions years to come. What he means is bank lending is freezing up. Credit crunch, we don't know how severe, is coming. And if bank lending and freezes up here, that means business investment is going to freeze up, and that means less stimulus to the economy, the U.S. economy and GDP numbers, i.e., in other words, recession becomes more obvious. At a time when consumers and households, particularly working and middle-class households, are tapped out, if you look at the consumer spending, after you adjust it for inflation, it's pretty flat. And what's occurring in consumer spending is mostly by credit cards. We got a record credit card debt here in the last 6 months, piling on top of it. That means consumers are tapped out in terms of their wage income. And once they start getting laid off, even more so, and you're going to see a contraction of consumer spending, real consumer spending adjusted for inflation. You see, the numbers they report for a lot of retail sales are not adjusted for inflation. So then they say, oh, you know, we still got a 3-4% income, retail sales growth. Well, yeah, we got 6% inflation, too. So in real terms, it's stagnant or declining. And if you look at the other indicators recently this past week, what do you see? Well, the Purchasing Managers Index, which shows whether manufacturing and services are growing, now shows manufacturing is contracting for the first time since 2009. The PMI, Purchasing Managers Index, shows contraction in the U.S. economy of manufacturing sector. right? And it showed a big drop in the services sector, PMI, Purchasing Managers Index. You know, it was like 54. Anything over 50 is growth, and it dropped to 51 in 1 month. Well, okay, you know, that means people are starting not to buy services the way they were. And services are the vast majority of the U.S. economy. But both, the point is both are going south. Both indicators for manufacturing services are going south. And that's an important indicator for the real economy, not the financial economy, not banking system, but the real economy. So very clearly, indicators that are harbingers of recession here are multiplying and deteriorating even further. That's coming. That's coming. Repercussions on top of the bank lending, and in other words, the business investment slowdown, credit crunch driven, what we're seeing is a steady deterioration of consumption. And as the global economy slows, that means net exports, production for export sales, is going to slow down too, and is. The IMF and World Bank both came out and said, the global economy is slowing down. And all this expectation about, China post-COVID opening up is going to stimulate the world economy, not happening. It's very slow opening and restoration of the economy in China. Very slow. Okay, so what we've got is the real economy is being battered here, and the financial instability is one of the new contributors to it, right? And bank crisis will continue to fall. Latest indicator for First Republic Bank, remember that one that they threw $30 billion at, Jamie Dimon and his big bank bunnies threw $30 billion at it to keep it from collapsing. Well, the stock price is still falling, 6% earlier this week, and now it's down 89%. Well, that's a damn zombie bank. Yeah, no one's going to invest in a zombie bank like First Republic. They're going to have to keep throwing money at it until it goes belly up and they don't throw money anymore. But, you know, as I said, the FDIC and the Fed are committed to throwing money, whatever it takes, at these individual banks. They're very loath still to throw money in general at the whole regional banking system. So they're sort of taking it step by step. But individual banks like First Republic, they'll attempt to keep afloat here by doing whatever they need. But it's a zombie bank already. And it really should go the way of the Signature and Silicon Valley Bank. If you want to watch what's going on in regional banking system, its fragility and stability potential, then you can look at the stock price. As I said, stock price is down in general on average 20-25% for these banks. You can look at the withdrawal rates, and you can look at what's the cost of insuring investors in a bank, that the bank, they'll get their money back through insurance if the bank collapses. That's called credit default swaps. Those are insurance contracts. And when you got to pay 20, 30, 40 cents per dollar insured, that means the bank's about to go. That was the case with Credit Suisse. Right before the weeks before the collapse of Credit Suisse, if you wanted to insure, if you were an investor in Credit Suisse and you want to insure your investment by taking out an insurance contract, it's credit default swap with another bank, it would cost you 38 cents for every dollar. Well, that means the bank's pretty much done. We'll continue to watch these indicators, stock price withdrawals, credit default swaps, to see what is the condition. And that's another reason why Jamie Dimon said, not over yet. You know, these indicators don't look too good. Not over yet. And, of course, the repercussions for years to come means bank lending and credit, right? not yet like 2008. He's right, but early phase, you know. Another report last week that's important here is the Saudi and OPEC oil supply cuts caught the U.S. by surprise. Now, really caught them off guard here. Saudi, you know, Prince bin Salman, whatever his name is, and OPEC Plus, which includes Russia, announced, I think it's 2 million barrel, 1 or 2 million barrel production cut. They're 1 or 2 million barrels per day production cut. Yeah. Well, you know, OPEC's a monopoly, a global monopoly. Call it cartel, right? And whenever their revenue from sales of volume goes down, they just raise their price to make up for the revenue loss, and that's what they're doing. Predictions are oil prices, which is $75 to $80 a barrel in global markets, will go, and these are bank predictions, will go to about $100 a barrel this summer. Okay, so that will be passed on to the consumer, and probably then some, which means gas prices are going up, folks. I've been predicting that for several weeks. You know, because now you got the big precipitator here, this global crude price increase coming at a time when U.S. oil companies, another monopoly here locally, oil companies in the spring always raise their prices because of the driving season, as they say, right? And the other reasons typically are, oh, there's a fire in the refinery down there in Houston, or, oh, we got to do maintenance, you know, for the refinery there in Louisiana. And somehow that has a big impact because the U.S. has a big choke point in refining capacity. They haven't expanded refineries in decades. So you can have a glut of oil in the ground, which they exist, but if you can't push it through that bottleneck because you don't have enough refining capacity, well, then prices go up. Plus, here's another factor. The U.S. is exporting increasing amounts of oil to Europe as the sanctions drove Russia out of Europe, increasing amounts now. You know, last year there were sanctions on oil in Europe, but it wasn't total yet. You know, the Russians were still shipping oil. Maybe the pipeline, not even all the pipelines were closed last year for oil and still not closed for gas. So, you know, there was oil coming from Russia and natural gas from Russia all last year. But now, you know, since December, that's oil flow from Russia from both shipping and the pipelines is now closed off. So the U.S. has to provide the oil to Europe, especially refined oil products. And that means more shortages of oil in the U.S. And that means less supply and higher prices in the U.S. Yeah, boy, that's going to whack Biden's and the Fed's inflation strategy, you know, because that's headline inflation. And that's inflation that the Fed can't do anything about. People are still going to have to drive, whether they have, you know, a job or not. Okay, that oil supply announcement by the Saudis was a real humdinger here for the U.S. economy and Biden's strategy and the Fed strategy, right? We're going to see sharp increases here. Already it's going up. I predict about a dollar a gallon more here in the second quarter, right? Okay, another announcement that deals with the Saudis that was important this past week was China brokered a peace deal between the Saudis and Iran. Whoa, that's a biggie, too. Again, caught Biden in the U.S., you know, off mark here. They didn't expect this. It's all an indication that many countries around the world are hedging their bets, not just with the U.S. economic empire, but, you know, with China. And we see a growth, for example, of the BRICS. You know, BRICS are this trading market deal. China, Brazil, Russia, right? India, China. Those acronym for BRIC, right? They've been trading, you know, special trade, like a free trade between them almost, a relationship for some time. But now we see a bunch of other countries petitioning to join the BRICS. South Africa's in there too. Join the BRICS. Which? Some important players. Argentina has petitioned to join the BRICS. Mexico, if it hasn't already, is about to. Turkey, maybe Egypt. These are countries, important economies in emerging market countries, some of them in the G20, and they seem to be drifting towards China, right? And the announcement is that even Saudi Arabia and China are going to start trading now using Chinese currency, yuan, not dollars. You see, up until now, in the heyday of U.S. economic empire, all these key commodities, oil, industrial commodities, agricultural commodities, had to be traded with dollars. You had to have dollars to buy and sell this stuff. Well, that gives the U.S. a lot of leverage, you see, over these countries. For one thing, if it's traded in dollars, the U.S. And its banks can see who's doing the trading. So it's possible that that's using the SWIFT international payment system. When you trade, when you buy and sell in dollars, you got to use that international payment system called SWIFT. That allows the U.S. to look in and see who's buying what at how much, you see. That's critical for sanctions. Well, you know, if you're not trading in dollars, you're trading in Chinese yuan, the U.S. can't see who's violating sanctions. And more countries are trading in yuan. I suspect India will make an announcement. Of course, Russia is already trading with China in using yuan, whatever you want to pronounce it. And this is a big move by the Saudis. Right, big move. Also, the trading bloc called the Shanghai Cooperative Organization, SCO, which is also kind of like a trade investment sort of relationship, is expanding. Right? So all these are indicators of weakening a global U.S. economic empire. Weakening. I'm not saying it's about to crash. I'm not saying that the dollar is about to disappear. But we're at an early stage, and the momentum is in that direction. It will be a long-term process. But it's one of the consequences of the dumb sanctions policy by the Biden administration to think that they can force these other countries around the world through strong-arm tactics, sanctions, to abide by whatever the U.S. says. Is really folly, and it's a big error, strategic error. They're finding out that the U.S. hegemony is not as powerful as it once was, and that's why the U.S. is kind of circling the wagons of its vassal states. You know, European countries are a vassal state. Japan's a vassal state economically. I'm talking about here, you know, Australia, New Zealand, and it's circling the wagons. Protecting its best asset, vassal assets here, getting ready to compete with China for the allegiance of a lot of the rest of these emerging market countries, you know, be it India or the Saudis or Argentina or whatever. But this brokering of the deal by China between Saudi Arabia and Iran is a big deal. It's going to make it much harder now for Israel to try to provoke Iran into a fight. With the new Netanyahu government, it looks pretty clear that the Israelis are trying to provoke a bigger conflict there in the Middle East. U.S. neocons may think opening a second front with Russia, because Russia's supporting Syria, opening a second front here might be a way to further weaken militarily Russia here. And then we have the Macron van der Leyen trip to China to talk to Xi, President Xi. That was interesting. You know, are they given a warning? Don't you provide supplies, military supplies to Russia or else, you know, or are they trying to cut a trade deal with China? In other words, the first would be the stick, the trade deal would be the carrot, right? Or maybe behind the scenes there's some negotiations or exploring of negotiations for a armistice or peace temporary deal in Ukraine. You know, the U.S. is covering its base just in case, you know, the Ukraine and Zelensky don't prevail with their announced offensive here. They start collapsing. Well, you know, U.S. will rush to try to stabilize the status quo with some kind of temporary peace deal with the Russians. You know, maybe that's why we got this talk going on in the background with China being mediator. Okay, those are the reports here of importance of last week. I want to move now on what time we have. Let's talk about the military status in Ukraine. Now, I'm not a military expert, you know, but I have had some exposure to in my youth here, ROTC and all that stuff before I got smart and dropped out, to what are some of the military trends of what's going on here, you know, especially since Blinken and Zelensky have pre-announced the new offensive coming, you know. A lot of this pre-announcement offensive probably is to justify more arms and continuing an increasing flow of military arms from the U.S. and the EU, right? But if you look back and try to assess the first year of the military conflict, what you see is that, you know, Russia invaded with an insufficient force back in February 22, right? 190,000. But you got to figure, you know, maybe half of that are actual combat troops and the rest are support. So you got about 90,000 of combat troops, and they were divided along four very large fronts. You know, you had Kiev, you had Kharkov and Donbass, and then down in the south, Kherson provinces. Now, 90,000, that's like one division for each front, one combat division for each front. That's certainly not enough to defeat. And I think the initial strategy of the SML was for Russia to try to intimidate, encircle the Kiev government and wait for them to collapse and then have negotiations and so forth with another government. Of course, that didn't happen. I think Russia underestimated the extent of U.S. military preparation of Ukraine and support for Zelensky, both military, politically, and just economically as well. And the government did not collapse, right? And the Russians found themselves circling most of Kiev, and they couldn't really take Kiev because in urban warfare, the offensive forces have to be about 10 times the size of the defensive forces, right? And, one major division around Kiev just couldn't do that. And the Russians realized that eventually when the Kiev government did not collapse. And the Russians then reconcentrated their forces in the Donbass and in the south, pulled them out, reconcentrated them. They weren't defeated. They just pulled out and reconcentrated. This raises what's called the principles of war. The first principle of war is concentration of forces. You know, if you want to, especially if you're on the offense, if you want to defeat the enemy, you have to simply mobilize far more forces than the enemy has in the field. And as I said, the Russians started with a meager force of only 190,000. At the time, the Ukrainian forces, the army, was maybe 200,000-300,000. But they had the advantage of defense, which meant that the Russians had to have at least 500,000 or more if it wanted to militarily prevail in the field. Now, what happened over the summer of last year is the U.S. Assisted Ukraine in mobilizing another 300,000, at least 300,000 over the summer. So the Ukrainian forces increased to more than 500,000. And of course, the Russian forces were at 190,000. And of course, there was some attrition there. So, you know, 500,000 minimum versus 90,000, maybe, even if concentrated in the Donbass and Kherson, was not sufficient, especially since it was clear that the U.S. began running the strategy and the tactics on the ground. U.S. generals were pretty much calling the shots since last summer. And the U.S., Ukraine, then concentrated its forces in the northern region, Kharkov region, against depleted and lines of resistance there in the north of Russian forces. So, you know, it was a disaster waiting to happen, and it did happen. And the U.S. concentrated forces in the north and punched through the defensive, you know, meagerly supported defensive lines of the Russians in the north around Kharkov and took a big swath of land in Kharkov, drove them back out of some major cities like Liman and some of the others, and drove them back to the Luhansk Oblast province line. And the Russians, of course, quickly reinforced that line and stopped the further advancement. So, again, the Russia concentration of forces was not sufficient even to defend the Donbass. That's why Russia mobilized here starting late last fall and probably has added about 300,000 forces, which is sufficient to prevent the Ukrainians from any great gains, further gains. And the battle has sort of focused around this city called Bakhmut. And the Russians use largely mercenary forces there, the Wagner Group, the professional military forces, to expend the resources. And the Ukrainians haven't put their best troops in there either, you see. And you've got, you know, this big slaughter field going on. Artillery mostly just devastating both sides. So that's where we've seen things occurring for the last couple months, mostly around Bakhmut, and the rest of the front has stabilized. As Russia builds up its forces to about 500,000 maybe, and at the same time, we've got another 200,000-300,000 Ukrainians being trained and soon to be thrown into the front. So the Ukraine will once again have an advantage in terms of concentration and total forces, manpower. And the U.S., of course, has been throwing new weapons at it, helping Ukraine, you know, prepare in terms of training. You know, the U.S. threw long-range artillery, well, medium-range artillery, you know, HIMARS and M77s. This is not the longest-range U.S. artillery, but it is longer than it's enough for the Ukrainians to target the supply depots and locations behind Russian lines and to try to select them. And the Russians are doing it as well with their artillery, which is probably a superior, certainly in numbers. And both sides are just sort of slaughtering each other. Ukraine is losing 300 to 500 men a day in the cauldron there around Bakhmut, but these aren't their best shock troops, and more are coming here. And it's a fight, not a fight, but it's an effort on both sides to increase their forces and try to concentrate them. Now, where will the concentration occur? Well, I don't believe it'll be in Bakhmut. That's not all that strategic. But if Bakhmut fails, then the Ukrainians will be pushed back to probably around the Kramatorsk line, major city there in Donetsk. I believe the offensive, when they come, will be a little further south, and the border there is Zaporizhia. And the Ukrainians will try to attack in that direction to drive a wedge all the way to the Azov Sea here and cut off Crimea from the Russian support. That's what they'll try. And I think the Russians, if they want to conquer the Donbass, are going to have to push north along the Dnieper River as well. So that's where the next battle, I think, is really going to be. And the question is, who has the larger concentration of forces? Now, the forces on both sides have probably deteriorated in terms of their quality. The best troops have already been wasted by Ukraine, and a lot of the fill-in troops here are not the very best. Probably you can say something to the same extent in the Russian side, but that typically happens in warfare. Human beings, men-at-arms get used up, and they start scraping the barrel for less qualified. And Ukraine, I think, has raised its draft age to 70. They're going to start recruiting guys who are 68, 69. Probably don't put them in combat, but in support positions. But that's a sign. And there's force drafting going on, grabbing people who are military age off the streets of the cities there. So they're getting a little desperate for manpower. As easily, they say in 100,000 we have been killed in the first year. I think it's probably closer to 200,000 on both sides here. So it's a real grind going on of men and manpower on both sides, but especially on the Ukrainian side. But the Ukrainians have short-term mobilized more forces. And the question is, can the U.S. leadership concentrate those forces for a successful will happen? And, of course, both sides are throwing in more advanced weapons day by day. As I said, the U.S. artillery, we've got new tanks coming. Question is, can the Ukrainians really handle these tanks? And there's talk about aircraft. The U.S. probably does not want to give advanced aircraft. So they're scraping the bottom of the barrel in Eastern Europe for aging former Soviet aircraft and sending those. But it's really an artillery war going on, and gee, the artillery is so efficient nowadays with smart bombs and targeting and the speed of which the artillery can respond, and it's devastating. Drones, of course, are a new form of artillery, loitering drones, looking for targets, choosing other targets, right? The quality and power of the missiles. Russia has been using missiles to destroy the infrastructure and military communications and transport system in Ukraine, including testing out its hypersonic missiles, right? They fire those from deep inside Russia, and they go so fast you can't stop them. There's no defense against hypersonic missiles. smart bombs and all that. So we see an escalation in terms of the number of forces committed. We see an escalation in terms of the quality of the ammunition. The equipment, the ammunition, of course. The U.S. announces almost every week another billion and a half, and so is the EU. That's ammunition. They're running out of ammunition. I've seen reports that say both sides are expending 10,000 shells a day, 10,000 a day. Right? Well, the U.S. does not have the production capacity for that right now. I believe the U.S. produces about 10 or 20,000 shells a month, and they're going to up that to 50,000. That's the high-impact artillery shells, the M77 and the HIMARS rockets. Well, the U.S., without a full war mobilization that it can't do politically, is not able to provide the ammunition. So they're also scraping the barrel of Europe for some of this ammunition, and some signs that even the Russian sources are not able to provide all the ammunition that they need. Certainly not all the drones that are being used. So they're destroying vast amounts of human beings, but they're also destroying vast amounts of weaponry here in this war. But we'll see where the concentration of forces, who can muster, the most and the best at a particular point here coming pretty soon here, I believe. And the principles of war, of course, are surprise and mobility. Well, the Ukrainians surprised the Russians in the Kharkov region. Mobility, lines of logistics and communications. The Russians have an advantage there, probably. Reserves, well, the Russians certainly have more of an advantage. But, without total war, there's political restraints to how many you can mobilize and throw into the cauldron there. The Ukrainians are throwing everything they've got, but they are coming to the bottom of their barrel. The Russians have political constraints from mobilizing. But if they wanted to, the Russians probably have a million or more men that they could commit if they want to. But the Russians aren't stupid. They're sort of, not committing the best and the most. They're waiting to see, because they know this is a war with the U.S. and NATO. Why throw everything into Ukraine here prematurely, wear them down, which is what they're doing, and hope that political opposition in the West will eliminate the commitment from the West? Because, if the goods and the money and the arms stop flowing, that's the end. That's the end of Ukraine. It's totally dependent on the U.S. and the EU for ammunition, for arms, for training, and so forth. And we got a lot of demonstrations going on in Europe now, particularly in France and Germany and places like that. People are beginning to question whether they should continue. So that's it for today, I guess. We'll see where this offensive is going pretty soon. I'm out of here.